Mr. Eisenberg?
Yes.
Okay, you may proceed.
Your Honor, it's set up for 45 minutes, so am I correct that we need to have 2.5 minutes?
Well, yeah, we were just gonna try to challenge you with the time, but why don't we just say 23 minutes aside, or round it at 50, 25 aside?
And I'm gonna attempt to reserve about 7 minutes.
Okay.
May it please the Court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing with Charlie Liu on behalf of the appellant Rayburn Lawn and Landscape. In the court's synopsis on the website regarding this oral argument, the synopsis says that this is a convoluted case, and I can't think of a better word to describe it. But there is a way that the court can decide this case in an easy manner without having to write a convoluted opinion, and that is on the issue of notice. We contend that as a matter of law, 6 years was unreasonable notice for Plaster to give to Rayburn of the defects. If the court agrees with us on that, then the judgment would be reversed, it would be sent back for entry of judgment in favor of Rayburn, and you wouldn't have to address any other issues in the case. For that reason, I'd like to address the notice issue first. The Plaster, the general contractor here, was first given notice of the block wall problems in 1996. 4 years went by before a lawsuit was filed, and during that 4 years, Plaster never said a word to Rayburn about any problems that Rayburn caused. Then Plaster got sued, and another 18 months went by before Plaster ever sent a letter to Rayburn demanding indemnity and a defense. And even in that letter, it was a generic letter that didn't tell Rayburn what they did wrong. So it was almost 6 years from the time Plaster got notice of wall problems until they gave notice to Rayburn. Now, we believe that although it's questionable whether Chapter 40 applies, we believe Chapter 40 does provide some guidance as to what the policy is in Nevada. And the policy is that contractors and subcontractors should get early notice of defects. It helps homeowners, it helps contractors, and it helps subcontractors, because if you give early notice, then problems can be fixed right away, problems can be fixed cheaply, and you can avoid litigation. And so we believe that, and Plaster says, well, there's no set time limit in this contract, even though there are three places in the contract where it requires notice to Rayburn if they do anything wrong. Plaster says, well, there's no set time limit. The law is, if there's no set time limit, then you apply a reasonable time. And we believe that under any standard, 6 years is, as a matter of law, an unreasonable time. And therefore, the condition precedent of notice was not satisfied, and we believe this court can rule as a matter of law that the notice was inadequate and the case should be reversed for that reason. If the court doesn't accept our argument on the notice, then the court will have to address the other issues. And the main issue in the case, obviously, is the order that the trial judge entered near the end of the trial. It was first called a motion for summary judgment, then later it was called a motion for directed verdict. Technically, it was a motion for directed verdict, but under either standard, under either type of motion, the trial judge was required to resolve all inferences in favor of Rayburn, the non-moving party, and to resolve all inferences against Plaster, the moving party. And we submit that on this record, the judge clearly didn't do that. The question here was whether the damages that the plaintiffs were seeking against Plaster arose out of the work that Rayburn did. And that was a question for the jury. There was overwhelming evidence showing that the plaintiff's damages claimed against Plaster did not arise out of Rayburn's work. Rayburn's expert testified. He said the damage we saw at the site was outside Rayburn's scope of work. Rayburn's scope of work had really nothing to do with these walls. I'm saying that based on my observations and analysis, it is apparent that the defect allegations are not related to the work of Rayburn Lawn and Landscape. Rayburn Lawn and Landscape did not cause or contribute to the block wall damage. The damage to the block walls has nothing to do with the work that Rayburn did. That was expert testimony. Yet Plaster says, well, there's no evidence from which an inference could be drawn in favor of Rayburn, and that this, as a matter of law, the judge was correct by deciding that the block wall damage did arise out of Rayburn's work. That finding was just virtually impossible. In addition, well, really, what the judge relied on was this so-called judicial admission. The basis for the motion, what was called a motion for summary judgment at that time, was a so-called judicial admission that Mr. Rayburn made. Mr. Rayburn was not a party in this lawsuit. He's an officer of Rayburn Lawn and Landscape, but he wasn't a party. Under grueling cross-examination, he was asked hypothetical after hypothetical after hypothetical until finally he was asked, if Plaster and Rayburn put dirt over these weep holes, would that have been a mistake? And he said yes. And that apparently is the so-called judicial admission that everybody's relying on. Well, first of all, they didn't put dirt over holes, they put sand. And the testimony was pretty much uncontested that sand was permeable, water could get through it, and it would not cause any damage, even if sand covered the weep holes. Additionally, the question was, if Plaster and Rayburn put dirt over the weep holes, would that be a mistake? And he said yes. Well, he may well have meant that it would have been Plaster's mistake. You have to remember here, Plaster ordered Rayburn to do these things. Plaster's theory here is against Rayburn. They say, Rayburn, you did exactly what we ordered you to do when we pointed out that weep holes were being covered and waterproofing was being covered.
Wasn't there some issue that there was also some other drainage design, alternative drainage design besides the weep holes?
Right, right. There were several things. Mr. Rayburn testified that when he got the job, he didn't even know what there were going to be there. So he said it's the normal practice not to cover the weep holes, but if you do cover the weep holes, it doesn't matter because the water can get through the sand, it's permeable, and Plaster's own on-the-job supervisors agreed with that. So the law here, we spent page after page after page in our opening brief, because this is an issue of first impression in Nevada. What is a judicial admission by a witness on the witness stand at trial? Page after page in our brief, discussing cases from around the country that say it has to be a clear, unambiguous statement of fact and not opinion and not any kind of legal conclusion. This is anything but that. Plaster's brief addresses it in a footnote where they suggest that it's within the judge's discretion as to whether or not it's a judicial admission. And we simply believe that that's wrong. That as a matter of law, this was not a judicial admission. And that was the only basis on which the trial judge here granted the directed verdict. Even if you accept the argument that Mr. Rayburn's statement was a judicial admission, all he admitted was that it was a mistake. He didn't admit that it caused any of the problems. Before they could get indemnity here, they had to prove that the damages the plaintiffs were seeking against Plaster arose out of Rayburn's conduct. There has to be some kind of cause and effect relationship. Even accepting Mr. Rayburn's testimony as a judicial admission, he never said or admitted that it caused it. In fact, it was the opposite, because he said the sand is permeable and water can go right through and won't cause any damage. And his expert said the same thing. So we believe that there simply was no basis for the judicial admission argument.
Mr. Eisenberg, does the untimely notice, under your argument, excuse also the duty to defend?
Excuse what?
Also the duty to defend.
The The timely notice requirement is, like I said, in three different places in the contract. The duty to defend is a sentence within the one paragraph dealing with indemnification. So yes, we believe that the two go together. And in fact, if you think about it, could you really have a duty to defend if you didn't get timely notice here? Now, technically, the duty to defend wouldn't arise until the lawsuit is filed, but certainly the duty to indemnify would arise much earlier. I would also like to point out the issue of apportionment. The trial judges here required Rayburn to pay 100% of the indemnification for Plaster and 100% of the attorney's fees and costs, $1 million of attorney's fees and costs, even though the allegations against Rayburn that weren't even made by the plaintiffs here, made by the by Plaster, were probably 5% of this trial, if you read the whole trial transcript. The other 95% dealt with the real allegations that the plaintiffs had regarding the block walls, and that was the fact that they weren't designed properly, they didn't have proper footings, they didn't have proper rebar, the backfill wasn't correct, all these things that Rayburn had absolutely nothing to do with. That's what the focus of this whole trial was. And perhaps the best example of the unfairness of this 100% allocation, it's not an allocation, 100% assessment, is the sidewalls. The sidewalls were not retaining walls. They didn't have weep holes or waterproofing. There wasn't a single word in 13 days of trial testimony here implicating Rayburn having anything to do with the problem with the sidewalls. The allegation with the sidewalls was that they were it was some newfangled design, and they weren't designed right, and one of them blew over in the wind. Rayburn had nothing to do with that. Yet Rayburn gets tagged with 100% of the indemnification, 100% of the costs and attorney's fees, a large part of which was Plaster defending itself on the sidewall.
And your contention is, with respect to the indemnity clause, that using the sidewall as an example, that those would not be arising directly or indirectly out of the obligations herein undertaken, because that scope of work is entirely distinct from the scope of work that Rayburn undertook in the subcontract.
Correct. Well, Rayburn did spread out some dirt all around the yards, and it may have gotten up to the sidewalls, but there was never any contention that any of the dirt along the sidewalls caused any problems with the sidewalls.
Are you contending that the indemnity clause is ambiguous in any way? And if so, how?
In several ways. First, the provision, the sole negligence provision, we believe is ambiguous because the paragraph itself only deals with the contractor and the subcontractor. But then it refers to the sole negligence of the contractor. Plaster is arguing, well, the jury assessed 1% to the plaintiffs, 99% to Plaster, and therefore Plaster was not solely responsible. And I would point out two problems with that. First of all, Mr. Liu was prohibited from arguing Plaster's negligence. Once the judge granted the directed verdict, she limited his argument. The only thing he was allowed to argue was that Plaster was not liable to the plaintiffs. So there's no way, without violating due process, I believe that that finding could be binding. But we also believe that the provision itself is ambiguous because it doesn't really say who you're comparing. We think it's the contractor vis-a-vis the subcontractor. Plaster and Rayburn are the only two that you compare. And that their idea that you compare other people, such as the plaintiffs or maybe other subcontractors, we don't think it's in there. And if it is ambiguous, then it has to be resolved against Plaster as the drafter of it and under case law that says indemnification agreements are strictly construed.
So the sole negligence clause you find ambiguous. Is there any other ambiguity that you identify in that arbitration clause, or indemnity clause?
Well, we believe that the provision about arising directly or indirectly out of the obligation is clear, and it does require a cause and effect.
Factual determination of cause and effect.
In addition to some kind of liability, they have to prove two things. First, that Rayburn did something wrong, and second, that what Rayburn did wrong caused the damage that the plaintiffs were seeking against the general contractor. As I stand here right now, that's the only ambiguity that I can identify, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The other issue regarding the duty to defend, I touched on that briefly. We believe that there was not reasonable notice given on that, and the duty to defend also still must arise from the improper work done by Rayburn. They're both essentially tied together there. This case also raises an issue regarding a new judge taking over after basically 4 years after a trial, and making findings of fact relating to the trial. Under Rule 63, a judge has to certify that the judge is familiar with the case and has read the record, and we believe that the judge, you have a 13-day trial, thousands of pages in the record, and if you read the judgment, we believe it's really clear that the new judge, Judge Barker, could not have possibly really read the entire transcript. He said he examined it, but he couldn't have read it. And he didn't, as the rule says, certify that he was familiar with it. And the reason I say that is there were a couple of findings he made that were absolutely 100% wrong. For example, he said, Mr. Rayburn testified that placing dirt above the block wall waterproofing and burying weep holes were a cause or contributing factor to the damage alleged by the plaintiffs. That is absolutely 100% wrong. Mr. Rayburn said the exact opposite of that. He said, I use sand, which is permeable. Water goes through it. It cannot cause the damage to these walls. So that was a finding that was in the judgment that...
Other than the efflorescence that he mentioned.
He also made the finding regarding the efflorescence, and he made other findings about Mr. Rayburn's... he said Mr. Rayburn testified that the portions of Rayburn's work were not performed in a good and workmanlike manner. Mr. Rayburn never said anything close to that. He always maintained that his people did the right thing there. What Plaster is saying here, and I'm getting down to about 7 minutes, and I would just like to conclude this part of my argument by pointing out what I started to say earlier. Plaster is basically saying, Rayburn, you did exactly what we told you to do. We knew what you were doing. We told you to do it. And then we sold these houses without telling the homeowners about these things. And then now that the homeowners have sued us, we want you to indemnify us because you did what we told you to do. Oh, and by the way, we also want you to indemnify us for 100% of problems that you didn't even cause and 100% of attorney's fees and costs that were incurred in us defending problems that you didn't cause. That's their theory, and the judges bought into it. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Mr. Paulsenberg.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Dan Paulsenberg for the respondent, Plaster Development. I think appellant's argument misses the big picture. This court said in Callaway, in an appeal from a summary judgment, sometimes it has to examine the legal principles, the district court's application and interpretation of the legal principles underlying the ruling. And this court quoted that line as recently as today in Justice Douglas's opinion in Hardy Companies versus SN Mark. And that's what I think we're dealing with here. This is a rare case where the appellant is saying it's a question of fact and the lawyer or the respondent is saying it's a question of law. But the issue here isn't how do we make this into a question of fact. Let's look at the legal principles that we're really addressing here, and that has to do with the type of indemnity provision that we are addressing here. There are a number of different types of indemnity provisions.
Mr. Postenberg, before you even get into that, I'm going to short-circuit you a little bit, but Mr. Eisenberg started that we could just deal with this on an issue of notice. How do you respond with that before you get off into
the merits? The notice provision impresses me as the greatest of red herrings. There isn't a notice requirement in the indemnity provision. There are some notes. Paragraph 9 has a notice provision if we want them to repair. It doesn't appear in the indemnity provision. There are no time limits in the indemnity provision. I've never seen a time limit on a tender of a defense. The timing of the tender of defense may affect certain sub-issues, such as what fees are covered and what fees aren't, but they don't raise that issue. In fact, the issues that they raise on attorney's fees, they just say it should have been tried at trial. They don't contest the amount of fees based on the tender of defense. So the notice provision is not a complete defense to them. It isn't. And similarly, if we want to address the issues that they're raising before we go to what I think is the real issue, this isn't a case about, as appellants say, so-called judicial admissions. The only people so calling them that phrase are the appellants. A judicial admission is admission by a party that precludes any other evidence in the case. The Ninth Circuit in the Coca-Cola case says you can't, in an affidavit, counter your own deposition testimony. This court has said you can't, in an affidavit, counter admissions made in request to admit. Those are certain kinds of admissions that aren't at issue here. Here we have just regular admissions. Look at the evidence involved. You had the principal for Rayburn coming in and saying, yes, if this had occurred, it would have been a mistake. He admits that putting topsoil, and he uses the word topsoil. Everybody in this case has used the word topsoil. Mr. Liu at trial, Dr. Christo Verich, their expert, both sides have used topsoil and sand interchangeably. It's not an issue where, apropos of no particular question, Mr. Rayburn can blurt out, oh, well, it's just sand, so it's permeable. No, all the experts have said that there's grout and sand and native materials that are blocking these weep holes. Now, they're really head joints, but we'll call them weep holes. There's no doubt, and Judge Sated did not say, I'm finding this to be a judicial admission precluding all other evidence. Judge Sated expressly, and we set it out in our brief, said, I am looking at all the evidence, I'm looking for the sufficiency of the evidence, and there is not a question of fact here as to whether their work was involved. Let me try to loop that back around.
Let me pause you there.
Yes.
So, crediting Mr. Eisenberg's argument that plaster was held liable to the plaintiffs for defects in the sidewalls.
Hmm.
Fair enough, right?
Yeah, it's a different issue.
But wait a minute.
Yeah.
Is that right? Was plaster held liable for defects in the sidewalls?
Plaster was held liable, and Rayburn was held to indemnify plaster on all the walls, including the sidewalls.
So the answer with respect to the sidewalls is yes.
Yes.
Plaster was held liable for them.
We don't know. And that's the problem that we have. Remember,
there was a defect in the roof that had been joined in this lawsuit.
Right.
Would your client be taking the same position that Mr. Eisenberg's client should be held liable to indemnify it for the roof defects and the costs associated with the defense of the roof defects?
No.
So why is it any different that he's arguing sidewalls were not, they were completely remote from the scope of work of this landscaping
subcontractor? Well, I don't think they were completely remote. Here's the problem that I had. I objected to all the plaintiff's claims going to the jury in a class action. When I objected to the verdict form of it not being broken down, I even moved to decertify the class. Now, this trial was before Beezer versus Schutte. And But the judge said, no, we're all going with all the injury, all the damages together because it's a class action. Rayburn did not object to that. They've waived any idea of all the walls being treated the same.
Well, no, because they wanted to go ahead to verdict, and they were stopped short of proceeding to final verdict because of the motion for summary judgment or JMOV or whatever they call it.
Before that. And what Mr. Pengilly says, I move for summary judgment, I suppose directed verdict. So it really is directed verdict. But before the motion directed verdict on that was the jury instruction and the verdict form where we were discussing, it's all in volume 17, and I believe it was before, that we were discussing whether all the damages all and every house go together in one lump sum. And Rayburn did not object to that. So for them to come in afterwards and say where the sidewalls should have been broken out when they didn't side with me, I think this is right, just like Landmark versus Moore, where if they didn't join in my position saying let's break it down, they can't later say, oh, well, it should have been broken down. And that's why all the walls were being treated the same in this case. And that's why in our brief we argue that this issue has been waived by them not joining us when it was time to break down the arguments.
But you're also making a direct contractual liability argument that in for a penny, in for a pound, if it touched the landscaping sand, they're obligated for indemnity under the indemnity clause, correct, or not?
That's a great argument. I'm not sure I'm making that. I am saying that all the walls are treated the same because all the walls were treated the same at trial and they didn't object to that. I think, and I am also saying that the sand actually was, I'm close to what you're arguing, because what this policy provides.
I'm not arguing anything. I'm trying to understand your position.
No, I've tried to keep from saying that for so long. I apologize. I'm close to the position that you're characterizing because it all had to do, obviously, placing the topsoil, or if you want to call it sand, but they use the words interchangeably, placing topsoil over the weep head holes on the bottom side of the wall, and on the top side of the wall over the waterproofing, and covering up the bad work done by others, is enough to be arising out of, indirectly or directly, the work done. And that is the key. And that was Judge Sada's analysis in this case. It's related to the work, not related to fault. There doesn't have to be the triggering device of their fault. There simply has to be a connection to their work. And this court in Federal Insurance versus American Hardware recognized that same principle in an opinion written by Justice Sada, where describing a companion endorsement for additional insured, where it says arising out of operations, that you don't have to prove that the named insured is at fault for the coverage to apply. And the reason that case is so important here is we're not just dealing with an indemnity provision. On page 2 of our brief, we set out the indemnity provision. It's incredibly broad. Broad in the sense that it only has to require a connection, not a causal connection, just some kind of relationship. The broadest sense, arising out of directly or indirectly to the work, the obligations undertaken in this contract or the obligations assumed by the subcontractor. If you have that connection, there doesn't have to be actual fault. And then we have on page 3 of the brief, we discuss the insurance provision, which although occurs after in the brief, it occurs before in the contract, where it says you will get, subcontractor, you will get insurance, and that it's supposed to comply with CG 2010. Now, that really should be CG, not GC 2010, which is the standard ISO additional insured provision that says that somebody else is an additional insured for anything arising out of the work. This is the same connection. It is I'm going to say that this is different from George L. Brown in three ways. First, we actually here talk about indemnity for everything except when it's our sole negligence. Second, it arises out of construction, as opposed to just a stray agency agreement. And third, it ties the insurance and the indemnity together. In construction, it's very important for us to have the opportunity to shift responsibilities around. And here we're not just saying, they argue in their brief, it's not fair for Rayburn to face all this exposure. Exposure is defined in the contract. We first say,
How is the connection made, Mr. Poulsenberg, in light of your expert's opinion?
Which expert's opinion, Your Honor? Which opinion?
The expert opinion referred to by Mr. Eisenberg in his opening argument that...
Some?
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, I was trying to guess which opinion. Are you saying where our expert said that some of this may be possible?
No, I thought the expert said that there was no connection to Rayburn's work.
I don't believe our expert said... No, he's talking about his expert, not our expert.
I misunderstood.
His expert said that. Our expert said that it is possible for these things to cause things. And the plaintiff's expert said, yes, what blocking the weep holes can double the pressure on the wall, knocking it out of balance. Covering the waterproofing can cause water intrusion into the wall, which would cause staining and ultimately degradation. What their expert said was simply, oh, no, it's not related. Now, we objected to his qualifications, and he doesn't explain any of those decisions. A judge is not obligated to let a case go to trial when all the testimony is that what was done was, first of all, I don't think we have to prove fault, but all the experts said, all the testimony is that it is their fault. Now, they may argue it's their fault and our fault together, but that's exactly what this is designed to look at, where it's our sole proximate cause. But if we're working with them and we together cause this condition, we still get indemnity under the provision. But he comes in the most conclusory, the most cursory fashion and says, this is not within the court. Mr. Eisenberg read you the opinions. That's the state of the opinions. All he did was state conclusions. He didn't explain them. A judge is not obligated on those conclusory statements where the expert is essentially acting as a lawyer making a conclusory argument to make the case go to the jury. This is, if it were summary judgment, this is what Wood versus Safeway is talking about. We don't need to let every case go to the jury on the hopes that some gossamer wings may cause the jury to say, oh, well, I don't see it here. There is no, and the judge, I say there's no dispute here. Judge Sada said there's no dispute here. Judge Barker says there's no dispute here. I mean, it seems to be that their argument is that we're just wrong on this, and that Judge Barker cannot have certified, the way they put it in their reply brief, he could not have certified this, although they concede that he did in the brief. He could not have certified this because his conclusions are all wrong.
Well, we give de novo review to this, wouldn't you agree?
Yes. For those, yes, of course, judgment as a matter of law, directed verdict, did be de novo review. But that's
and indulge the inferences in favor of his client.
The legitimate inferences, but see, that's where I think their argument about so-called judicial admissions is upside down. They're saying what the principal of Rayburn said was not so clear and unequivocal as to be a judicial admission precluding all other evidence. I say, you know, it's not so clear a denial that there's a question of fact here. If this condition exists, let's assume, as they do, that this is a hypothetical condition, a hypothetical question. If this condition exists, then it is wrong on their part. Well, the condition does exist. And if he admits it's a mistake, then it's a mistake. But I don't think I have to go that far as to prove their fault. I think if I had to, I could. And we say in the brief that we can. But the whole idea here is that going into, and the reason why construction...
But you would have to prove that the damage arises indirectly from an obligation undertaken by the subcontractor pursuant to Exhibit A to the subcontract, the scope of work. And isn't that his point, that there's a factual issue with respect to the bundle of claims the plaintiff made as to whether those all are indeed related to that scope of work?
No.
I'm mistaken on that then. Tell me why on that.
Here's why. Clearly, there is a connection to for their work to the damage.
Arising directly from their work?
Yes. Yeah, they're covering the weep holes, they're covering the waterproofing. That's a connection, directly or indirectly, whether they were at fault or not. That is
sidewalls.
Enough of a connection.
How do you deal with the sidewalls at that point?
Okay, first I'm dealing with the connection. Then what they seem to be arguing is, remember when we sued Rayburn, we also sued Bill Young Masonry, who built the walls. And what they seem to be arguing is that that's the party who's more at fault or at fault for other parts. I'm not really sure what their argument is on that, but it seems to be along those lines. Well, we sued Bill Young on the same contract. They had the same contract with the same indemnity provision and the same insurance provision.
Yeah, but a different scope of work.
Well, more accurate... More
Exhibit A would have been different.
Well, yeah, but their scope of work would have also touched on this. And I think that that's what what Rayburn is saying. It's not fair for us to be liable for things that Bill Young did. But Bill Young got out, settled the case, $250,000, and a good faith settlement was approved, and they're out. Now, what they could have done here is said, well, Bill Young should still be liable under their indemnity provision, just as we are liable, Rayburn is liable, under Rayburn's indemnity provision. They could have contested, they cite Converse in their supplemental authorities. They could have argued at that point that Converse should not be out of the, that Bill Young should not be out of the case, and that Bill Young should be liable under its indemnity insurance provisions for the things, for parts of this. And since they didn't argue that, and since they let Bill Young get out of the case, I think, number one, they waived the issue, and they're in the situation, as we described in our brief, where they're really, they were jointly and severally liable under the circumstances, and when one of the parties got out, they're jointly and severally liable for the rest, even if they could have been severally liable if Bill Young stayed in the case and the jury apportioned. When they did not...
But it's contract-based. It's not a...
But that's why there would be an exception to the good faith settlement. But the good faith settlement, they did not... they didn't appeal Bill Young getting out. They could have either objected to...
Well, by the same token, neither did you.
Which is consistent with my position now. Where they're being inconsistent in their position. They're saying they shouldn't have to pay... For parts of this.
For Bill Young's work.
Yeah. But the way to preserve that issue would have been to keep Bill Young in the case.
So do you agree that, do you concede that they ended up paying for defects in Bill Young's performance of Bill Young's subcontract?
I have not addressed their argument for the sidewalls. And I understand their position on the sidewalls. But that's such a small part. And I think it's waived three times over. By their not objecting to Bill Young getting out, by their not objecting to the whole case going to the jury on a single amount of damages.
Can you address the insurance clause and its impact on how we should interpret the indemnity clause?
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor. When they argue that indemnity provisions should be construed against the drafter, basically what we'd be looking at here is if we have the provision in the indemnity provision and the insurance provision both saying that arising out of, that you'd wind up being construing it two different ways in the same case. Since we call for insurance to cover this, this entire contract should be read so that the indemnity provision and the insurance provision, it's a meeting of the minds with the parties that they're both allocating it off to an insurance company. We're not really allocating it to Rayburn. We're allocating it to Rayburn's insurance company. And it doesn't, in that sense, it fulfills the idea that contracting parties, sophisticated construction contracting parties, can in advance allocate risk and have it set in advance. That's the problem I have with the idea of trying to make so many factual issues in this case, is because if we adopted that there were all these factual issues, there would be no benefit in having an indemnity provision that would stop litigation. Because as much as we may all enjoy it, our clients do not really like litigation. It's time-consuming, especially in this case. It's spent, and so this contract should have been read to shift it all to the insurance company. But Judge Sada didn't even have to get that far, because she, even dealing with it as whether an issue would be going to the jury, the judge said, look, this is the broadest form. Now, it's not the broadest form in a type 1, type 2, type 3 sort of indemnity provision. Where it's the broadest form is that the triggering device doesn't depend on fault. The triggering device is simply some nexus, very broad, with their work. And it was here, it was found here. I don't think anybody could argue, that there was no connection with the work. Now, there are three kinds of indemnity provisions. There's broad form, there's narrow form, and then there's the intermediate form. The broad form is was discussed by this panel in George L. Brown, and that was, are you indemnifying a party for its own negligence exclusively? That's not what we have here. There is the it does provide here that if it is our sole negligence, that we're not indemnified. So there are two different spectrum that we're dealing with. One is, what is the degree of negligence involved on the indemnitor, the party seeking indemnity? And the other one is, what is the triggering device? And I think Judge Sada caught that in her decision here. And it shows when you read federal insurance versus American Hardware. The only last point that I'd like to address is the Sandy Valley issue. You know, I've been thinking about the position that I took in Beezer, and I'm not sure that it made any sense now that I look at it. Because what we have here is a situation where we are suing them in indemnity for the attorney's fees that we're generating in the exact same case, because that case is still going on. I think the only time that damages would be an issue that would go to the jury as opposed to the judge deciding it is if this had been a case where we had just looked. You know, that happens a lot in construction defect cases. Plaintiffs sued defendants, the contractor, the general contractor. Sometimes the general contractor brings in the subs, sometimes it doesn't. If we hadn't brought in the subs here, and we had simply fought with the plaintiffs and brought a subsequent action against Rayburn, our fees would have been set and not ongoing. And so I think in that situation, it might go to the jury, but it couldn't in this one. One last point, speaking of ongoing, they make the argument in their briefs that that this shouldn't have been for something in the past, that this indemnity provision was only for ongoing operations. In federal insurance, you see the type of insurance clause that applies to ongoing operations. It actually says ongoing operations. Here it said obligations. It didn't say ongoing obligations. And it also cited CG 2010, which has been interpreted as applying to past work as opposed to more recent. It's the 1185-2010, which applies to past work, not other versions of that endorsement, which say ongoing operations. Thank you, Your Honor.
Several points I'd like to address. The first one is the apportionment issue. Counsel argues that we waived the apportionment issue. Mr. Liu argued until he was blue in the face that the jury should be allowed to determine how much damage Rayburn caused. Once the judge decided that as a matter of law, a directed verdict would be rendered against Rayburn, she cut the legs out of his, the rest of his arguments. She rejected all of his jury instructions, all of his verdict forms, and when he argued that, please judge, can we have the jury decide how much damage Rayburn caused, the answer was no. So to say that that was waived somehow, whether it dealt with sidewalls or footings or backfill or anything else, it just is not correct. Topsoil versus sand. Counsel says, well, everybody referred to it as topsoil. That was a question for the jury. They didn't have to believe Mr. Rayburn if they didn't want to, but they could have believed him if they wanted to. It wasn't for the judge to decide whether it was topsoil or sand, but he said, without contradiction, that the whatever you call it, it was permeable, water would get through it, and Plaster's own supervisors on the job agreed with him that water could get through it and it wouldn't cause any damage. And not a single Plaster supervisor took the witness stand and denied having told that to Mr. Rayburn.
Would you agree or disagree as to the position that there were inconsistencies as to the use of the terminology sand versus dirt, topsoil, whatever you want to say?
But there were. Some people called it topsoil, some people called it dirt, but Mr. Rayburn was clear. He called it sand, and he explained that it was sand and that it was permeable. And the jury had the right to accept that. Mr. Polsenberg says, he says that this indemnity provision is so broad that it just has to be related to Rayburn's work or have some connection to Rayburn's work. That's not what it said. If Plaster wanted to put that in the contract, they could have said those things. But instead they said it had to arise out of Rayburn's work. And I suggest there's a big difference between some vague related to and arising out of. And the example I used in my brief was a painter paints a house the wrong color and then the house collapses later on because it's not built correctly. Well, the painter's work, it was a mistake, the wrong color is related to the house, but it didn't cause the house to collapse, so there wouldn't be any liability or indemnity imposed on the painter for that mistake. But that's the kind of broad interpretation that they're asking for here. He says, and I put quotes on this statement that Mr. Polsenberg made. He said, all testimony is that it was Rayburn's fault. I'm not sure he used the word fault, but he said all the testimony. That is absolutely incorrect. Mr. Rayburn denied it. Mr. Rayburn's expert denied it. And speaking of his expert, that was for the jury to evaluate whether or not the testimony was believable. Was it too vague? Was it? He testified for 60-some pages, giving detailed descriptions about the documents he reviewed. He went out to the site. He inspected it himself. And he testified that the damage he saw was not related to Rayburn's work. The jury had the right to accept that or reject it, but it wasn't for the judge to do that. As far as the insurance and the relationship with the indemnity, I'd point out that the insurance issue was never raised at trial. As a matter of fact, the exhibit, if you look at the contract, the subcontract in the record here, it doesn't have an insurance provision.
It's redacted.
It's redacted. The only place you find it is in the letter that Plaster wrote later on, and that's what's quoted in their brief. But this issue of insurance wasn't raised at trial. But even if it had been, the insurance is tied to the indemnity. It didn't require Rayburn to buy some general insurance that would cover every single thing that would happen on the project. It only required Rayburn to buy insurance that would cover the indemnity obligation, which was an obligation for problems arising out of Rayburn's work, not for other things. The judicial admission. Counsel suggests that the only people who are calling it a judicial admission is us. Well, that's wrong. As I recall, maybe I'm wrong about this, but my recollection is from the record that Plaster's trial counsel told Judge Seda that Mr. Rayburn admitted certain things, and then the judge later on said, you admitted them. And she concluded that he was bound by that, and that because of that testimony, and that the only reason, I believe this record reflects, the only reason she granted the directed verdict. Well, I was also going to point out regarding the apportionment. Council argues that the issue of apportionment was somehow waived, but the complaint, the third-party complaint itself, had a cause of action, third cause of action, and it was labeled third cause of action for apportionment. And it sought apportionment, quote, according to their respective fault of the subcontractors. And then the fourth cause of action was for express indemnity, and it sought damages for defects and damages claimed by the plaintiffs that were caused by third-party defendants arising out third-party defendants' performance of contract obligations.
Right. The award here was entirely based on express indemnity, correct?
Correct. They waived implied indemnity once the judge ruled in their favor on the directed verdict. Those are all the points I wanted to make on rebuttal. Unless the court had some other question, we believe this judgment needs to be reversed and remanded either for entry of judgment in our favor or at least for the trial. Thank you.
Any questions by the panel? All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefs. We thank you for your input on this case. And the matter will stand submitted, and happy holidays to all of you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll be in recess.